pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. It is a great day before another great day. Tomorrow is Halloween. That means that tonight is Devil's Night. At least it has been in Detroit. What does that mean? We will get to that discussion later in the show. But first, with Halloween coming up, one of the stories, one of the costumes, one of the characters that is often immortalized by Halloween trick-or-treaters and others is Frankenstein. And Frankenstein goes back to this old science fiction dream of crazy scientists creating life in the lab. Well, in this Science and Culture Hour, we talk about a scientist who at least says he's not crazy, who claims that he has created life in the laboratory. And to speak about that, we speak to another scientist who I know is not crazy, because I know him very well. His name is Dr. Paul Nelson. He is a fellow of Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. He received his PhD from the University of Chicago in the philosophy of biology and evolutionary theory. He is widely published, and he also appears in a pair of beautiful and highly recommended new documentaries. You can get them on DVD about the evidence for intelligent design in birds and in butterflies. They are called Flight and Metamorphosis. Dr. Nelson, always great to speak with you.
Michael, thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so appropriate for this Halloween theme that the world is concerned with right now. Tell us all about Craig Venter. He claims that he has synthesized life in the lab. Did he really do it?
Well, you know, it's interesting. What he claims is somewhat more modest. He claims to have shown that life can be reduced to physics and chemistry because it's possible, in fact, he's done this, to synthesize a complete bacterial chromosome from scratch, that is, from four bottles of chemicals, and to take that synthetic chromosome, put it in another species that doesn't have any DNA, and it boots up and runs. So he's been rather careful to distinguish what he's doing from actually synthesizing a complete cell. But there are moments in his new book where he intimates that that we're on the path towards being able to do that. In fact, his current research attempts or is going to try to show that one can synthesize a minimal cell literally from scratch. We'll see.
1-800-955-1776 is our phone number if you want to join in this conversation. One of the things that was striking to me that about Dr. Venter is there's this interview with him in the New Scientist magazine. And the interviewer says, but you inserted artificial DNA into an existing cell. Isn't that a bit of a con? And Dr. Venter says, we're not trying to recapitulate the origins of life. Obviously, life evolved from much simpler systems. Okay, this is what's interesting to me. How could life evolve from much simpler systems? Is there any claim or any evidence anywhere that inanimate matter ever evolves? Do rocks evolve?
No, and in fact, if you look at the systems that Venter is using, they are enormously sophisticated. And I think here's a key distinction that needs to be kept in mind, and I can illustrate it by way of an analogy. Suppose I tell you that late in life I've taken up musical composition. In fact, I've written a complete symphony in four movements, and it's going to be performed by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, so you go down to Symphony Hall, you take your seat, the conductor raises his baton, and what you hear is dee-dee-dee-da, dee-dee-dee-da. In fact, what you hear is Beethoven's Fifth, performed without a flaw by the CSO. But you come and meet me backstage, and you say, I'm beaming, you know, and I ask, what did you think? And you say, Paul, I think you need to work on the difference between composing and copying. And composing, as Beethoven did, he brought, by his creative genius, into the universe something that did not exist before. What Craig Venter is doing is a remarkable technological feat. I don't want to take anything away from him, but I think it, in fact, illustrates design. One of the problems that his team ran into is they found that as they were synthesizing these chromosomes, they had to keep the errors down. The error rate had to be kept down as low as possible, or the cells wouldn't work. In fact, Michael, they found something so remarkable that I hope you'll give me just a moment to describe it.
Please.
Okay. They were using a genus of bacteria called Mycoplasma that are rather small, but they have a lot of DNA, about 1.1 million base pairs. Okay, they synthesized the chromosome, the whole 1.1 million base pairs, insert it into cells that don't have any DNA, but the cells won't grow. They're dead. They can't figure out what the problem is, so they go back and painstakingly, base pair by base pair, they look for the mistake. And what they found was there was a single error. One base pair out of the million plus had been deleted. Without that base pair, the cells wouldn't grow because it was in a protein that was essential hardware. You know, it reminds me of the requirements for a Torah scroll. There are very strict rules for copying a Torah scroll. You cannot insert a single letter. You cannot remove a single letter. So one base pair out of over a million was deleted. The cells wouldn't grow. They went back and fixed it, and they found that the cells would grow. And Venter, in his book, he actually features this discovery. And here's how he puts it. He said, a single letter deletion out of over 1 million base pairs of DNA made the difference between life and death. I can think of no more dramatic illustration of how information plays a central role in life. So the bottom line is, if you want a functional cell, you have got to be meticulous in maintaining the fidelity of the information that's there, or you'll be on the death side of the line, not the life side, indicating that random processes which count, you know, which produce errors are exactly the wrong kind of process to generate the information-rich structures that one needs for a living cell.
1-800-955-1776 is our phone number. To go back just for a moment to Frankenstein, which is obviously part of the theme of this bizarre holiday season, which I don't like particularly, but we're going to talk about that tomorrow. We have our great Halloween debate coming up, but with my wife who does like Halloween. But the point about this, Dr. Nelson, is that even Frankenstein was not somebody inventing a new form of being in the lab. The idea was that, according to the story, now the story, this is interesting, the story apparently was inspired by an experiment by Darwin's grandfather?
Yes, in fact, Mary Shelley was hanging out with Byron and that whole crew, you know, on the shores of Swiss Lake, and they got to talking, and someone had read the writings of Erasmus Darwin, where Darwin talks about the idea of spontaneous generation. Now, Mary Shelley actually mishears what's said, and she thinks that Darwin has a piece of vermicelli, which is pasta, that came to life. In fact, what she heard, or what was said, was actually the name of a biological species. So she misheard it and wrote it down as vermicelli, and that's what survives in Frankenstein, the novel, today. But the idea was that...
Oh, so in other words, in having not read, I'm sorry to say, the original Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, she has an animated piece of spaghetti before Frankenstein puts together the dead body parts.
A piece of spaghetti begins to move. Now, to be fair to her, she admits that her recounting is probably inaccurate.
So and she was also like, she was very young when she wrote this book, right?
Oh, yeah.
She was like 19 or something.
Yeah, just a kid. But, you know, she had this, I mean, look at the longevity of the story. It's made, you know, all these different movies and different variations on the movies. In any case, the idea is that you have an inanimate thing that somehow achieves the living state. So she takes that notion and says, what if we did this with a human being? So it's a corpse, you put enough electricity through it to animate it, and then the story ensues. Of course, if you put that much current through a corpse, you would have barbecued corpse. I mean, it's not going to come to life, it's just going to burn.
Okay, and this is H.P. Lovecraft has the Reanimator, it's the same kind of idea. Do you, as a someone who is very familiar with evolutionary theory and biology, What do you think the chances are of us developing this kind of technology?
You know, Michael, I would not put it past our ingenuity to come up with methods, technologies that enable us to devise very, very clever biological objects. But here's what's going to be the case.
Okay, you're going to have to tell us what's going to be the case coming right back from this break with Dr. Paul Nelson, Science and Culture Hour. Your call's coming up.
1-800-955-1776. The Michael Medved Show. That's 1-800-955-1776.
Discovered the great ray that first brought life into the world.
And your proof?
Tonight you shall have your proof. I am going to turn that ray on that body and endow it with life.
And you really believe that you can bring life to the dead?
That body is not dead. It has never lived. I created it. I made it with my own hands from the bodies I took from graves, from the gallows, anywhere. Go and see for yourself. It's alive. Oh, it's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive.
In the name of God. Now I know what it feels like to be God.
Twenty-2 minutes after the hour on the Michael Medved Show, a memorable scene from the original Universal Pictures Frankenstein movie starring Boris Karloff famously as the monster. That film inspired, of course, by Mary Shelley's book, which was written more than 100 years before the movie and was already very popular and influential. Both go to this whole idea of recent claims by Craig Venter that he himself has created life in the lab. Well, not exactly, says Dr. Paul Nelson. However, he doesn't put a Frankenstein scenario totally beyond reach. This is our Science and Culture Hour. Dr. Paul Nelson is a fellow, senior fellow of the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. Okay, Dr. Nelson, you were saying that you wouldn't put it past contemporary science to do something Frankenstein-like. And now, how's that? What's the big caveat you were going to introduce?
The big caveat is, to go back to my parallel of musical composition, it will be copying. It will be the kind of engineering that takes a natural template, an existing cell, let's say, studies it very carefully and tries, using our methods, to mimic what's already there in nature, what already works. All life that we know, that we actually have examples of, uses DNA, RNA, and protein. So if we were to ever synthesize something that we would say approximates the living state, it's going to be by copying nature. Now, the key evolutionary or Darwinian claim is that undirected natural process brought this about. Now, that's the thing that this kind of research would manifestly refute. It's very clear from Venter's book, for instance, that they took great pains to solve really fundamental engineering problems, for instance, in putting together this bacterial chromosome. They found, as I said earlier, that the error rate in their synthesis was too high, and so their proteins didn't actually function. So they had to keep the error rate as low as possible using very careful engineering methods, showing that the use of human intelligence is necessary, absolutely necessary for any kind of viable outcome. So look 50, 100, 200 years into the future as our technologies improve, what they will show is that if you want any kind of interesting biological result from these sorts of experiments, it's going to require a lot of very creative, hardworking minds, intelligence. So that's the main caveat, or really it's a pair of them. You're going to be copying what's already there in nature, and you're going to be using your brain power, your mind to do it.
Let's go to John in Louisville. You're on the Michael Medved Show with Dr. Paul Nelson.
Yeah, I can't understand how an apparently intelligent person comes up with the ideas that Dr. Nelson is putting forward. There is nothing more beautiful and time-consuming than the fact that nature randomly produced all the life that exists. So, you know, why would some intelligent being take millions of years to produce it if he was intelligent? He wanted to get it done very fast.
Okay, John, you're shorting out. I mean, because of, I don't know, lack of intelligent design with our phone connection right now. But, John, Paul, did you hear the basic point? He said, look, how would you explain if there is some force in the universe, if there is a pattern in the universe that is so supremely intelligent that it can preordain life, why wouldn't it do it all at once? Why would it have the life as we know it evolve over the course of millions, if not billions, of years?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, but it's a theological question, and it presupposes a particular conception of God that I don't find plausible. I mean, if we're talking about God as the designer, so let's move now into theology, God is perfectly free to do as he pleases. Now, the caller may not like the methods or the time scale or the narrative by which creation or bringing this world into existence occurred, but that's not a scientific question that can be settled by evidence. That's something that is based, let's say, on the aesthetic preferences of the caller. So I am always cautious to put myself in the role of what I call Dr. Seuss biology, where I say, well, if I ran the zoo, I would have done it this way. Look, we don't even know how proteins fold. So I think it's a little bit of hubris to say that this is how the designer ought to have done things, whether all at once or over a long span of time. I'm much more interested in finding out what's actually the case and what's the best explanation for what we see.
Let's go to John in Linwood, Washington. John, you're on the Michael Medved Show with Dr. Paul Nelson.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
I've got a little biology background, just enough to cause me a lot of mental stress. I'd like to bounce an idea off your guest about internal activities of cells, particularly of the ovum and the sperm as they fertilize each other. You've seen these pictures with that little ovum surrounded by sperms, like hundreds of them. I'm thinking that in order to meet with time constraints on life systems.
We have some time constraints right here. Can you get to the question? Because right now we just have a big ovum surrounded by hundreds of little sperm. Actually, I think it's thousands, but go ahead.
Entry point for one sperm to enter. Otherwise, the nucleus in the ovum, people assume it's just floating around randomly waiting for that other nucleus to join it. My theory is that there's one opening, one sperm, and the time for those two nucleus to join is very specific. Otherwise,
okay, John, let's get a response from Dr. Nelson.
I'd like to comment on that.
Please.
In our species, a single sperm fertilizes the egg, and then there's a rapid block that occurs that keeps all the other guys out. Now, in some species, like in some species of frogs or salamanders, you can have multiple sperm enter, but only one ends up forming the new nucleus. So they have another mechanism that shuts down the other sperm that get in. In any case, you have a tightly regulated, very, very carefully orchestrated system to ensure that the maternal and the paternal DNA form the new set of DNA for the developing.
You learn the most fascinating material on the Michael Medved Show. We will be right back with Dr. Paul Nelson.
1-800-955-1776. The Michael Medved Show.
Michael Medved Show with Dr. Paul Nelson of the Discovery Institute, where he is a senior fellow at the Center for Science and Culture. And with Halloween coming up tomorrow, that means that far more important holidays are not far away, including Thanksgiving, Christmas, Hanukkah. Actually, Thanksgiving and Hanukkah come together this time of year. Don't you want your place looking just as beautiful as it possibly can, go to Blinds.com to upgrade the coverings of any window in your home. Use their new face-to-face video conferencing chat. It's free. They can give you advice on what will look absolutely perfect on your own windows at home. Blinds.com, where prices crush home improvement store prices. Dr. Paul Nelson appears in and has helped to shape two wonderful documentaries that will provide even more amazement about the splendor of creation than our last caller. And those documentaries are called Flight and Metamorphosis. Amazing stories about birds and butterflies, not birds and bees. That was the last call. Let's go to Nadav in Highland Park, New Jersey. Is it Nadav?
Nadav, yeah.
Yeah, Nadav, go ahead.
Hi, Paul. You were talking earlier about copying and that it's not really it's not a new act of creativity. And you also said we don't even know how proteins fold yet. I was looking at your body plan argument and Steve Meyer's argument from epigenetic information, and I was wondering if while we can actually sequence DNA and chromosomes today, do you think that our technology has to advance rapidly forward before we can start replicating things like the sugar code and the developmental gene regulatory networks, which actually help development? Or do you think that we're pretty close to that as it stands? It's just a matter of copying the existing information.
Paul?
It's not stored in DNA. One of the parts, and this is a fascinating topic being explored by some of my colleagues at Discovery Institute. One of Craig Venter's new book is wonderfully readable. I recommend it to all the listeners. It's a fascinating tale. But one of the things he claims that I think is actually not so is that life is fundamentally encoded in DNA. Now, that's just not true. Dennis Noble at Oxford has pointed out, he's a physiologist there, quite senior, that if you put DNA in a petri dish by itself, come back a year later, it will still be there and nothing will have happened. DNA chemically is a remarkably inert molecule, wonderful for storing information, but it does almost nothing. When Venter transplants DNA into a bacterial cell, that is not just an empty bag that he's putting the DNA into. In fact, it's loaded with machinery, without which you could never get the information out of DNA. So there are large chemical factories, literally factories, already present there in the cell that extract the information contained in the DNA. And what the caller is referring to is the information that apparently cannot be collapsed into DNA, that's contained in cell membranes, for instance, or in sugar molecules, which have an enormous variety of configurations that turn out to be essential for normal biological development. So while I have great respect for Venter, I love his papers, they're some among the most interesting in biology, I think he's just wrong to say that life can be reduced to DNA. It can't.
Paul, one of the things that is fascinating with everything that you're talking about, especially you're speaking about how just a tiniest little difference in this act of copying that you're talking about makes the entire thing non-workable. What it really goes to is the astonishing complexity of even the most simple elementary life forms. In other words, we are supposed to believe, according to random, unaided Darwinian evolution, that all of this complexity evolved flawlessly by accident.
Yes, and it's just not so. In fact, years ago, I told Bill Dembski, a colleague of mine, that origin of life researchers should work in labs that are lined with mirrors, so that they can see the role that they themselves play in bringing about meaningful results. The late Robert Shapiro at NYU, who was a very astute origin of life researcher himself, but also a critic of much of what went under that name, said it's like watching a three-card Monty game where you're listening to what the player is saying, but you're not watching his hands. Shapiro said, watch their hands.
Okay, we will continue watching the hands right here on Cleaning the Hands of the Clock. on the Medved Show with Dr. Paul Nelson.
The Michael Medved Show. MichaelMedved.com. Portions of the Michael Medved Show are brought to you in part by the Discovery Institute. To learn more, click on the Science and Culture banner at MichaelMedved.com.
And you can go there now and find out all about the new DVDs, A Flight and Metamorphosis, in which Dr. Paul Nelson is involved. He, of course, senior fellow at the Discovery Institute. Dr. Nelson, one of the things that we were speaking about is the work of Craig Venter. And I understand that part of his work involves the claims of junk DNA. And junk DNA, as I understand it, is always brought up by people as proof that Darwinian evolution is a reality, because we are supposed to be carrying around with us all more advanced forms of life, all kinds of DNA that serves no real purpose, as a relic of our the earlier source of our species, our various species. What does Venter show that actually shows that maybe junk DNA isn't so junky after all?
Well, Venter approaches biological systems with a very healthy attitude, and that is to recognize that he's looking at sophistication. Now, he attributes that to natural selection, but he realizes that his own ignorance of what's in front of him is no justification for saying it's just, you know, a holdover from millions of years of evolution. So his opening attitude is a healthy one, namely to say, I don't know what it does. It probably does something, and it's my task as a scientist to figure out what that might be. And another aspect of his personality as a scientist is very important, and that is he thinks like an engineer. This is very clear from his current research. He wants to know how to build cells. So when he approaches living things, he's reverse engineering them all the time, and when he sees a patch of DNA that has no apparent function, his reaction, and this is clear from his work, is to say, well, maybe the function is very sophisticated and not immediately apparent to me, and I just need to do a lot more hard work to figure out what's there. So I would say, in a sense, he's a de facto intelligent design engineer. Now, he would reject that because his own view is evolutionary or naturalistic, but when you look at what he actually does, it's chock full of the kind of reasoning that an intelligent design theorist would employ. What's there? What might it be doing? How can I figure out how it's working? And one final point, he lets himself be surprised. So after he sequenced the human genome, he went sailing around the world, sampling seawater, sequencing DNA right out of the seawater. Most single-celled organisms cannot be grown in culture, but you can still extract their DNA. And what he discovered is millions and millions of genes that no one had ever seen before. And that radically changed his understanding of the so-called tree of life. He does not today think that Darwin's tree of life actually existed. He doesn't think there was a single common ancestor for all life on this planet. So he allows himself to be surprised by nature, which I think is a wonderful attitude for a scientist to have. Bottom line, I would say, if you approach living things with the attitude of respect, namely saying, I'm looking at something enormously sophisticated and it's my job to figure out how it works, you are bound to discover things and not attribute them just to a junky, kludgy process with no mind.
Let's go to Vic in Honolulu, Hawaii. You're on the Michael Medved Show with Dr. Paul Nelson.
Hi, Mr. Medved. In regards to some of your earlier callers that had suggested if we had an almighty creator, why did it take the almighty creator millions of years, there's emerging evidence and books that actually poke holes in the millions of years concept that's been forced down the throats of many university students.
Yeah, I don't want to go into the young Earth theories because, well, Dr. Nelson, do you want to comment quickly on that?
Yeah, I just want to say that the caller, the initial caller who said, why would it take so long? There's no way to answer that question other than taking a leap into speculative theology. The right attitude to have is to say, you know, what does the evidence show, whatever the time scale happens to be?
What does the evidence show, Dr. Nelson? What does the evidence show in terms of the age of the Earth?
I would say the standard view of 4.6 billion years is what's accepted by most of the fellows at Discovery Institute, but that doesn't bear on the question of intelligent design. You could have 50 billion years. Write yourself a blank check on time, and you would still not be able to get a single functional cell. So the question of time, to my mind, is actually independent of the question of design, because the things we're looking at, the probabilities are so vanishingly small that availing yourself of more and more time is just not going to help.
Appreciate the call, Vic. Thanks. Let's go to Chris in Weaverville, North Carolina. You're on the Michael Medved Show with Dr. Paul Nelson.
How are y'all doing today?
Doing well.
Hey, my question is, back in Sri Lanka, they had like 60 days of blood rain, red rain. And come to look at it, they had cells that had absolutely no DNA in it, but yet they still replicated, even when heated up to temperatures over 300 degrees. My question is it possible that cells and DNA can integrate through natural means to break that cell wall?
Dr. Nelson?
Coming from space or whatever.
I'm afraid I'm not familiar with the evidence that the caller is referring to. Our red blood cells, our own red blood cells, don't have any DNA, but that's because they need to use their internal space to carry oxygen. But red blood cells are themselves produced by tissues that have DNA. And as far as I know, every living thing on this planet, its actual free living cell from the smallest bacterium on up, they all have DNA. So I think it's just not the case that you can have a functional cell without DNA.
What about this idea? If you put aside the Darwinian tree of life, and there appears to be suggestions that life evolved in different places, different sources, different kinds of life. What about the idea that many secularists believe that it's just inevitable that there should be life on other planets?
Well, you know, I think there's a confusion there between necessary and sufficient conditions. People will say, well, give me liquid water and I can give you life. Well, I'm sorry, give me a flask of sterile water and it will be sterile water 5 years from now. It'll be sterile water 100 years from now.
Or 100 million years from now.
Necessary conditions for life are, there's a world of difference between that and the sufficient conditions where you actually have the working recipe.
In other words, what you're saying is that oxygen, water, various components that we know about are necessary, but there's a lot more that's necessary that people don't know about or generally acknowledge. We'll be right back with Dr. Paul Nelson coming up. Minutes past the hour on the Michael Medved Show. You just have a short while more to sign up for a big event that we have coming up Sunday here in the Seattle area. If you live in the Seattle area, it's an Elliott Bay Harbor Cruise. It will be lunch and listen and talk and question with me and my colleague on this radio station, David Bowes, and the brand new and very exciting dynamic Republican Party chair in the state of Washington, Susan Hutchison. Go to our website, michaelmedved.com, and sign up for that cruise this Sunday. And if you go to Discovery Institute or the Science and Culture website, you can sign up for a much more substantial cruise. It's a week-long cruise to Alaska in July. They're not cruising to Alaska right now. But together with my friends Dr. Stephen Meyer and Dr. John Lennox, a renowned Oxford University mathematician, they'll all be on that Alaska cruise this upcoming summer. Let's go to your calls for Dr. Paul Nelson, a fellow of the Center for Science and Culture. Richard in Louisville, Kentucky. Richard, you're on the Michael Medved Show with Dr. Nelson.
Hello, gentlemen. I have two questions and then an assertion.
Okay, you're going to have to go quickly. Go.
Do both of you gentlemen believe in the God of the Bible?
Do I believe in the God of the Bible? I don't know about Dr. Nelson.
Yes, I do.
All right. Do you believe that the God of the Bible created all life on earth?
Yes.
Yes.
Therefore, by definition, you are creationist, and intelligent design is just a mask for the discredited specious arguments of creationism. And that's all I have to say, and everybody out there needs to know that. Thank you.
Okay, Dr. Nelson, you want to comment on that first?
Well, it's interesting how evidence and argument can be turned away by a label. And all I can say in rejoinder is, call me what you want, just look at the evidence I present and make up your mind. I find it a very silly and actually self-condemning strategy to say that if I give you the right name, I don't have to listen to what you say. It's just nonsense.
Yeah, and the idea of to say that one believes that the universe was created, I mean, what is the Big Bang theory if not creationism by his definition? In other words, how would you explain that all of the universe, all of matter, comes from a tiny little scrap that exploded in a very, very long time ago? That sounds what someone might describe, in fact, as creationism. And as a matter of fact, this is one of the reasons that there is a politician who I don't want to name who said the Big Bang Theory was a lie from the pit of hell. Actually, I think the Big Bang Theory is one of the most powerful pro-theistic ideas ever. Many powerful ideas in the work of Dr. Paul Nelson. Thank you for what you do for opening minds and eyes and hearts in this greatest nation on God's green earth.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.